Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And we're going to take you to Mars one-ish.
Maybe.
It's
a possibility.
So Mars
That's
One.
The plan.
Yeah, Mars One. It's this proposed project that would set up a human colony on Mars,
funded mostly by the televisation of the entire process.
Yeah. So essentially turning a space exploration and colonization project into a reality TV show in a way. Actually, more than just in a way.
A giant reality TV show, an entire, 13-year series of reality TV shows.
Which is pretty impressive to sit there and say that any particular property is going to maintain interest in the public for at least 13 years. And maybe it will, but it's kind of an interesting approach to this question of when are we going to actually set up a colony somewhere other than on Earth, like on Mars.
And proposing the fact that it can be not only commercial, but driven specifically by
public interest, really.
Uh-huh.
I mean, because here's the thing, is that we know that the government officials that are behind things, like the space industry in the United States anyway, are facing increasingly difficult battles in funding, right? It's getting harder and harder to get a working budget. And some of that is due to problems that the various space industries have had, specifically what NASA has undergone, where NASA's had a few projects, more than a few maybe, that some would argue were improperly governed, so that they ballooned out of control as far as budget and timeline is considered.
Oh, and partially this was also due to just everyone at the outset not understanding exactly what kinds of issues were going to crop up along the way and what kinds of problems would need to be solved.
Right. And sometimes it was because, you know, it wasn't necessarily mismanagement, but it might be that, you know, you have very limited people you can go to when you need something like an enormous rocket. And if the only company that provides the enormous rockets that you need says, you know, I know that originally we were going to say that this was going to be, you know, $20 million per rocket, but in reality it looks like it's going to be closer to 65, you don't have a lot of options left. So
right.
I don't mean to suggest that NASA was really bad at managing this stuff. It's just that a lot of several high-profile projects ended up getting bogged down in lots of problems, which...
And when you're publicly funded, it's a lot more difficult to handle that. This private funding could hypothetically, you know, eke around some of those problems. You could sell more advertising space or something like that.
And, right. I mean, that's the whole idea behind the privatization of space exploration, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that they aren't tied down to things like tax income. They don't have to go and petition the government.
They don't have to answer to the taxpayers.
That's right. But they do have to raise those funds some other way.
Right.
Because it's not like they just magically have access to those giant rockets.
Uh-huh. The supposed funds that Mars One will require to establish the settlement is $6 billion.
That sounds
so low.
Phenomenally low to me.
So low. But it's starting with just four settlers. To expand hypothetically by teams of four every 2 years, and they're aiming for the first round of settlers to land in 2023 is the current proposed date,
which is 10 years away.
Yeah,
I mean this is already blowing my mind, and we haven't even gotten into what the actual challenges are yet. But just the challenge of getting the materials together, testing your various spacecraft, because obviously you're going to have to design special spacecraft for these teams to go up in.
Mm-hmm. They're talking right now to Elon Musk and the other kids over at SpaceX.
Right.
About using their stuff.
Which would be important. I mean, mm-hmm. like using the Dragon spacecraft, that kind of stuff. I mean, obviously, that would be something they'd have to take into consideration. It seems really ambitious. That's not to say that it can't be done or that they shouldn't try. I think being ambitious is fantastic.
Oh, absolutely.
It's just one of those things where, having seen how difficult it is to get a space project, and I hate to use this phrase, off the ground, tells me that things are going to have to go really, really well for them to make that budget and to make that timeline.
Right.
Maybe it will. But let's talk a little bit more about what this whole project is. So, yeah, the first team lands in 2023. Now, the thing is that in order for anyone to land on Mars and have any expectation of being able to survive there, other stuff's going to have to get there first.
A whole bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, because Mars doesn't have any supermarkets. So you would need some way of getting supplies there. And I mean, you know, you can't just pack everything you would need
into a single rocket. That would be very inefficient. That would be way too much weight.
Right. Yeah. The more weight you add to your launch vehicle, the more fuel you need. And the more fuel you need, the more weight you add to your launch vehicle. There does come a point where your launch vehicle is too heavy for you to be able to launch it using the fuel sources that we typically use here on Earth.
And they are planning a space launch rather than an Earth launch of the actual crew module.
Interesting. I did not read that part. So mm-hmm. you'll have to tell me more about that if you get a chance.
Sure. But let's back all of this back up. So the Mars One project is run by by two parts. There's a nonprofit foundation called Mars One, mm-hmm. and there's a for-profit company called Interplanetary Media Group.
Which makes me laugh so hard that they are interplanetary, serving all your needs, whether you are on Earth or somewhere else.
I do wonder whether the nice people who founded it are on Earth or somewhere else.
That is a fair request. Are you from here?
Both of these organizations are based in the Netherlands, co-founded by Bas Lansdorp and Arno Wilders.
All right.
And Lansdorp says that he got the idea when he saw the revenue figures for the International Olympic Committee a bunch of years ago.
Huh.
And said, hey.
There's money there.
There's money there. There's money in televising these epic human events.
And you also uncovered that that Interplanetary Media Group, there are different organizations that own shares in Interplanetary Media Group. Who owns the majority?
The Mars One Foundation owns almost 90% of the shares in Interplanetary Media Group.
The nonprofit arm of Mars One owns 90% of the for-profit arm of the project.
It's also the sole supervisor of the for-profit sector's operations.
Wait, so the nonprofit organization oversees the for-profit arm of this. Now, this is just, it raises alarm flags in my mind. However, I will say, if this works, it's a brilliant way of funding this because, the nonprofit part can take any money that's generated
directly from.
Right. And there's no processing fee or whatever you want to, there's not a convenience fee here because they have this governance and they have this ownership of the for-profit arm. And if that money indeed is going to fund this Mars project, that's exactly what they're going to need in order to have that a massive amount of capital they're going to need
because
all the stuff.
Because the foundation is going to be the owner of the settlement on Mars and the employer of the mission teams.
Right, and then IMG, the media group, is essentially in charge of generating funds through things like the televised broadcast of the process of selecting people to go to Mars. And then once they get there, their ongoing experience on Mars.
To be live streamed, televised 24/7, 365 days a year.
Yeah, it's Big Brother, Red Planet Edition. And then they're also going to be generating money through things like merchandising.
Oh, right. And IMG will, in fact, hold exclusive rights to use this project to generate revenue through broadcasting, advertising, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. So you've got this interesting approach to trying to fund space colonization. Obviously, the only way this really works is if it captures the public's attention enough for them to want to watch it, right? Because otherwise, that flow of revenue isn't going to come in.
It's going to dry up immediately.
And and then they don't have any money to build or buy all the stuff they need in order to get things to Mars. So let's talk a little bit about what they are looking for, because clearly they need to have people
right.
who want to go.
And I would argue that part of this application process that we're about to talk about proves that the interest is there, because within the first 2 weeks that applications were open, they got 78,000 applicants.
Yeah, that's a huge number. And the application process is still open as of the recording of this podcast.
Right. Yeah. This is it opened in April of 2013. Mm-hmm. We are recording this in May of 2013, and it will be open until August 31st of 2013.
Right. So
there's still time.
Still time. And they say that they expect 500,000 applicants by the time it's all over. Because obviously that first rush is from all the people who hear about it at the very beginning. Now, before you rush out and fill out your application, maybe you should learn a little bit more about the parameters of the mission. This is more likely than not a one-way ticket. You will not be coming back from Mars. If you were to go to Mars on this mission, there is every possibility that that is where you would have to spend the rest of your life.
The expense incurred to get you back here would basically not be worth you.
Well,
no offense to you.
Beyond that, I mean, just the logistics of designing a spacecraft that could lift
enter Mars
off of
and
Mars.
Then lift back off. Sure.
Yeah, you'd have to have even more fuel so that you could escape the gravity of Mars. Remember, Mars's gravity is not that different from Earth's.
Yeah.
So you would have the same issue. Now the atmosphere's thinner, so you'd have less air resistance, but that's kind of negligible when you're talking about gravity.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, to create a spacecraft that could get there and then launch from the surface and come back is beyond the scope of this project. So that leaves you literally on Mars. So if you don't want to spend the rest of your life there, you probably don't want to apply.
To apply very seriously.
They're looking for people who are at least 18 years of age or older. Keeping in mind, you will be 10 years older if you were selected to be one of the four people who go up on that first launch.
As of May 7th, the oldest person to apply was 71 years old.
Yeah.
Which seems like probably he won't be chosen.
Yeah. No, we don't know that for sure. And it's interesting that how they're going to go about choosing the people who go through this process.
Right. There's first of all a whole bunch of application of selection criteria.
Yeah.
And did you want to say?
Sure,
sure.
They're looking for people who have the following characteristics. And this is because they need people who are going to be psychologically prepared for the challenges, for the
training and for the trip and to be stuck on Mars for the rest of their lives.
Right. And they have to not only have the psychological foundation, but they also need to be willing and able to pick up new skills. Because clearly, you're talking about a tiny number of people ultimately on that colony. It's just, you know, not many at all. So everyone needs to be able to do pretty much everything. Just like astronauts aboard the International Space Station have to be adept at working with all the different systems and be able to react if anything goes wrong. Same thing holds true on the colony. So, you know, if you were to apply, you'd have to be willing to go through some very rigorous training to learn how to deal with any situation that they can come up with that could conceivably happen while you're on the colony.
The plan is for about six to seven years of training before launch.
Right.
For the first group.
Which, you know, also on television.
Right.
So the characteristics they're looking for resiliency. And they break these out by practical applications. So for resiliency, they mention that your thought processes have to be persistent. You persevere and remain productive, even under difficult circumstances. You see the connection between your internal and external self, meaning that you're very self-reflective. These get a little metaphysical as they go on. You are at your best when things are at their worst. That is not me. I'm already out. I mostly turn snarky when things are at their worst.
Yeah, yeah, you do.
Also when they're at their best. You have indomitable spirit. Nope, mine's totally domitable. You understand the purpose of actions may not be clear in the moment, but there is good reason and you trust those who guide you. That's terrifying to me, which is essentially saying, shut up and do your work. I understand what they're saying. They're saying like, look, we may tell you to do something that requires you to endure uncomfortable circumstances for an extended amount of time, but trust us, it's all in your best interest. That always gets me a little worried. That you have a can-do attitude. The next criteria is adaptability. Clearly this would be necessary on this kind of project.
Oh, right, right. Like Jonathan was saying a second ago, you need to be able to do everything up there. So, out there.
Right. And I love that I won't go through all of the practical applications of this one, but one of them is, you know your boundaries and how and when to extend them. I didn't know that boundaries were that flexible, right? Like, I guess if you have boundaries
maybe
of what
like
you
one
are...
of those international boundaries. It's kind of, you know, always in question. And
right.
Not really...
Where it's just the dotted line instead of the solid line.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe it's like you would be willing to do this and no more. But you, in certain situations, would be
willing to do more. Totally do more.
Yeah. Again, kind of terrifying. Next would be curiosity, which, again, if you don't have a sense of curiosity, I can't imagine
why are
you
going to Mars?
Unless you're just sick of everyone here, which, I mean, maybe you are. Maybe you're just a misanthrope and you're thinking,
I want a
like,
team of total misanthropes
just
going
a whole
to
bunch
Mars.
Of people
that would be great.
So it would just be like the Algonquin round table, but in space. Which would be kind of awesome.
I would watch that show.
And they talk about the desire to transfer knowledge to others and not just showcasing what you know or what others do not know. I think that knocks me out too, because I prefer the second version of that. No, seriously, that's one thing I actually do like. I like to share knowledge because I find knowledge exciting.
That's probably why you're on a podcast.
That is
several
why I'm
podcasts.
On a podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah, a couple of them. And then there's the ability to trust, which would be very important since you're working with people who, you know, your life depends upon their work just as their lives depend upon yours.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to be creative and resourceful, which means that, you know, kind of have that hacker mentality that if a problem comes up, you find a way to solve it, even if you don't have a manual that tells you what to do in that specific situation, that you can adapt to the situation as necessary. You know, maybe the manual tells you to react in a specific way if one particular situation arises, but maybe the situation is more complicated than that, and you can't just do one solution because that's not going to meet all the criteria to fix the problem. That's why you have to be both creative and resourceful.
Right.
So that's like the basic features that they're looking for in the people who apply. And then the way they choose or the way they start to narrow down the candidates is also kind of interesting.
It's like I said, the applicant pool was opened up on April 22nd, mm-hmm. 2013, or I said April. It was on April 22nd. And it does cost money to apply, between $5 and $75, depending on the wealth of your country of origin.
Gotcha. So if you're from a more affluent country, then mm-hmm. your application fee will be higher.
I think the fee here in the United States is $38.
Interesting. So it's $38. I'm curious to see which countries are on the top of the scale.
I did not look that up, so I have no idea. But
I'm just wondering out loud because, you know, it's that national pride coming out. What do you mean $38? Why aren't we $75? Not that I'm applying, but.
This applicant pool is going to be pared down during the course of several rounds. The first is by popularity, because part of the application is you know your resume and this very short psychological workup, and then part of it is a YouTube video that you are supposed to upload.
So how many people are watching and liking your video?
Right.
It's like having a clout score for going to Mars.
Yeah.
And again, I could see someone who is just really misanthropic winning just because people are like, yeah, get rid of this guy.
Shoot him into space. John. So this first round is going to be by the popularity of your YouTube video.
It's like American Idol, but you shoot them into space.
Yeah.
All right. Go ahead.
By the application material, the company is actually looking at your resume.
Right. Right.
In this first round,
they don't want to send a whole bunch of people who obviously have no business working any kind of intricate system.
Yeah, right. There's no point in advancing those people to the next round. The next round, speaking of, is going to be selected down by region and based on the person's health, various background checks, and in-person interviews.
Also very important. Now, obviously, you want to have people who have those features we talked about earlier that are well-rounded, that can work well with others. You don't want to send a bunch of psychopaths up in Mars, people who don't care about anyone else, because that would be counterproductive to the mission at large.
Sure, sure. Misanthropes, yes. Total psychopaths,
no.
Not so much.
No.
After that, you're going to start seeing more of a crowdsourcing process via reality TV shows, internet polls, stuff like that.
Right. Even when they narrow this down to their pool of potential astronauts, and I think they were aiming to get to around 40 total. When they finally boil it down.
I've seen a couple different numbers, but yeah.
The idea being that not all 40 of those people would necessarily end up on those colonies. It's rather that this is the pool of astronauts that could go up. And throughout the television series, we might even see something where the audience decides which four would be the first ones to go.
Right. It's going to be they're going to start narrowing it down by TV and stuff. And two people, a man and a woman, would be selected from each applicant country. And then they will, them plus a few judge favorites who are not crowdsourced, will proceed to an international round and then be grouped into fours. Some 50 teams of four.
So 200 people.
And, which will be narrowed to six teams who will train full time.
Gotcha. So then you're down to the 24.
Then you're down to that. Right.
Right.
And then, yeah, in 2022, that would be when, they would select whatever groups are ready to go. The company would select the groups that they think are good to actually astronaut.
And then the world gets to call in and vote on which people get shot into space.
Yep.
This is incredible. All right. And then you had a specific quote from someone who had applied, right?
NBC News found out that sci-fi author David Brin who wrote, for example, The Postman, I believe.
Okay.
And a bunch of other stuff. He told NBC that people can't imagine any sane person making this choice. Editor's note, the choice to go to Mars forever and never come back.
Right.
Simply aren't envisioning the wide range of human diversity. And was just talking about, you know, the fact that he's got three kids and that at the very earliest date that Mars 1 was going to launch, he would be 75.
Which means his kids are grown up and on they're doing their own thing at that point.
Uh-huh.
They're in their careers. So it's not like he's abandoning children.
Sure, sure. And, you know, he might choose to spend these last few years of his life doing something truly remarkable.
Interesting. And we should say that the early stages of this would require the candidates who were selected to move on in the process to undergo some extensive training, like we mentioned before, but they'd probably be going someplace really remote and pretty desolate.
Yeah, one of the plans of the group is to create on Earth in some cold, desolate, desert tundra kind of area, a little faux Mars base. And for training purposes.
That'll become really important because you have to understand what's the harsh reality of trying to live on Mars. But before we jump into that discussion, we want to take a quick moment to thank our sponsor.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Mr. Worldwide himself, Pitbull.
A lot of artists in general, people that are very creative, sometimes tend to overthink. That's one of my number one rules. Don't ever overthink. You can think ahead, but don't overthink. And what I mean by that is when they start to write a record, they're like, oh, that's not the line. Oh, that's not this. Oh, it's not that. And everybody has a creative process. I'm not knocking it. For me, I just let it flow.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, so we've laid out what the project wants to do and kind of their general approach, the idea of sending up supplies ahead of time and then landing people hopefully by 2023, mm-hmm. Four people and then initially and then another four every 2 years, and that they're having this Mars colony. So let's talk about why this would be a monumentally difficult task. Like what are the challenges that they face?
Because there are quite a few. You're dealing with not only when you get to Mars, it not having an atmosphere,
Well, it has a thin atmosphere. It doesn't have a breathable atmosphere.
Not having the atmosphere that Earth does that lets you, you know, go out barefoot and walk around.
Right. Yeah, not only that, but there's we'll get into it.
Sure.
Let's start with the dirt.
Yeah.
Mars dirt.
Because Mars dirt is toxic.
Yeah. Just like Britney Spears. Oh. No, wait, she just did that song.
I guess you could say either one that you wanted to. I'm not going to argue either point.
Okay.
So the dust that covers Mars is called regolith.
Mm-hmm.
If I am pronouncing that correctly.
You are.
Excellent. Win. It's really human unfriendly. It contains a bunch of things. For example,
perchlorate.
Perchlorate. Yep. Thank you. Which is a group of chemicals that are used as oxidizers in rocket fuel.
Yeah.
And if that doesn't give you an indication, it sucks to breathe in. Exposure can cause serious damage to your thyroid.
Wow. Yikes.
Which is an important bit. Lots of silicates. Silicates.
Silicates. You're right.
Trust
your instincts.
Most commonly, including feldspar, pyroxene, mm-hmm. and olivine,
mm-hmm.
All of which react with water to form hydrogen peroxide, hydroxyl, and superoxide. All of which quartz dust does, and is blamed for things like lung cancer and silicosis,
right.
in miners, which basically means that you inhale this dust and it reacts with the water in your lungs and it is not good.
Right. This is it starts to form chemicals that can be very harmful and lead us to a not living situation.
Right. Another thing in there is gypsum, which is a sulfate mineral that forms again in the presence of water. This one isn't actually toxic the way that the silicates are, but mm-hmm. On the level of coal dust, it is an eye, skin, and respiratory irritant.
So, obviously, we would have to take precautions against getting dust into any habitable area in the Mars One colony.
Oh, right. And again, because of the atmosphere situation, you're not going to have people running around barefoot in Mars dust. However, it's a very sticky substance, really.
Right.
And especially due to static electricity, it's going to wind up getting on all the equipment and... You know, even if you get it out through air filters in some kind of airlock, it's going to get into the system.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you really have to design like a clean room type environment, the same kind of environments that we think of for creating a microprocessor, where even a single mote of dust can ruin a sheet of silicon wafers when you're trying to design a microprocessor, because you're designing things on such a tiny scale. We would need that level of precision to ensure the health of anyone who's living on one of these colonies. Not to say that it can't be done, but when you are doing this on another planet that's already essentially trying to kill you, it's a really, really tough challenge.
The way I've seen it described is that it's not so much that at a certain point you're never going to get the dirt completely separated from your living quarters. And so it's almost more of a what can we do to combat the issues that this dirt is going to cause.
Yeah,
then...
have some sort of chemical scrubbing process that
sure.
could make this inert.
Or some kind of medical process that we can act upon the poor human people that are out there.
Gotcha.
Because it's gonna affect them.
Right.
So
yeah, to even think that we could create a system that would negate all of this is probably being a little too
wishful. Yeah.
Yeah. You definitely can't just assume that, because as soon as you do, then tragedy can strike.
Right.
Well, there are other challenges as well, not just the dirt. There's also radiation.
Yeah, and before you even get to the planet.
Yeah, because a journey to Mars is going to take months. And that's because the way that Mars and Earth line up. You have to figure out the right trajectory to launch to get from Earth or even Earth's orbit to Mars in the most efficient way possible. So when the Curiosity rover launched, You know, if you were to look at the closest point between, well, when Earth and Mars were closest together, if you were somehow able to maintain that distance and go from Earth to Mars, it might take you a few months to get there. It took Curiosity rover more than, I think, like 8 months to get there. And
right.
You might say, well, why is that? So, well, it's because we can't get those planets to stop moving. They keep going around the sun.
Continues moving through space itself.
So what you're talking about is trying to create a trajectory that's the most efficient pathway between Earth and Mars. And it's not a straight line, because you can't do that. You would end up being where Mars was, as opposed to where it is. So you have to actually aim for where Mars will be. So that means that your journey through space is going to take some time.
If you did it at the speed of light, it would be 14 minutes.
Right.
We cannot go at the speed of light.
Right. So it's going to take months to get there. And the downside of that is that space has got some nasty radiation out there that can kill you. So if the vacuum's not bad enough, the radiation is worse. So on Earth, we are very well protected. In fact, one of the reasons why we have life as we know it here on our planet is because our planet has two things really helping us out. One is the atmosphere we have, which helps reduce the energy of any incoming radiation particles coming into the atmosphere. It slows stuff down. And then also we have a magnetosphere, this magnetic field that surrounds the Earth that repels a lot of the particles that otherwise would bombard our planet. Mars has a very thin atmosphere, so it's not as protective, and there is no magnetosphere around Mars. So there's not that magnetic, you know, you can think of it almost like a force field. There's not that magnetic field that can repel charged particles as they come blasting through space. And what's blasting them, you might ask?
The sun.
Yep. Yep, the same thing that allows life to happen here on Earth in almost every case. I mean, there's some life out there that relies on chemicals that are produced geothermically, but
most of it is through some kind of route of photosynthesis and then eating things that photosynthesize.
Right, exactly. So the sun is responsible for most of the life on Earth. It's also blasting out stuff that would kill you. Now you might think, well, what about people who are aboard the space station? How do they manage to stay up there so long?
It's a lot of shielding.
And they're still inside the magnetic field of Earth.
Correct. And they're really only supposed to stay there for a few months at a time.
Yeah,
it's one of the many reasons why they try to bring people back pretty frequently.
Right, right. Yeah, another one being things like bone loss, which you can suffer if you're out in space for a very long time.
Yeah.
So if you are going out from Earth to Mars, you will eventually get to a point where you leave Earth's magnetic field while you're in space. And once you leave that magnetic field, the only protection you have from this kind of radiation, this cosmic radiation, and it's radiation in a different form than, you know, it's not energy beams coming at you like you would think in a 1950s science fiction film. Cosmic radiation or cosmic rays are not made up of light energy. They're actually the nuclei of atoms like hydrogen and helium and iron that are traveling at hundreds of thousands of kilometers per second through space that have been ejected by the sun. And the University of Rochester Medical Center published a study not that long ago that suggested that long exposure to this kind of radiation could increase the risk of developing diseases like Alzheimer's.
Huh.
So, you know, exposure to this stuff is dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
So you would have to build some form of shielding within your spacecraft so that if there were a period of cosmic radiation, you know, the sun's not constantly blasting this stuff out. It comes in these little short bursts.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were to detect such a burst coming at the spacecraft, you would have to be able to go into a specially shielded compartment and wait it out. And it usually lasts a few hours. So actually, Mars 1 is fairly cavalier in saying, like, it wouldn't be a very comfortable situation. You'd be kind of in cramped quarters for about, you know, 3 or 4 hours. But, you know, after it's over, you could come out.
Huh.
It sounds to me like you'd be essentially knee to knee with the other astronauts waiting for this to finish.
Well, but you're clearly best friends with them after going through 6 years of extensive training on a desert base on Earth.
Hoping no
with
one.
With TV cameras in your face.
Yeah.
Because no one ever cracks under that kind of pressure.
Right. And hoping that no one had the chili, space meal just
space
before
chili.
You had to go in there. Yeah, space chili. That'd be bad. Boy, Chris would have appreciated that joke like crazy. Well, anyway, that's something you would really have to deal with on that whole trip from Earth to Mars. Once you get to Mars, the thin atmosphere does provide some protection. In fact, I saw one report that suggested that information from the Curiosity rover may show that it's non-lethal levels of radiation. Now, that does not mean that
they're good for you.
Yeah. It might still increase your chances of developing certain diseases, but it wouldn't outright kill you. Like there are radiation levels that are so high as to give you radiation poisoning, which can be lethal. But the point that he was making was that, they aren't that intense on Mars. Now, we're recording this, just a day before NASA releases more information about the radiation on Mars. So by the time you hear this, we'll know more about it, but Lauren and I don't because we can't see into the future. So how does Mars One expect to deal with the radiation problem on Mars? Well, even with it being non-lethal, obviously you don't want to have prolonged exposure to radiation if you can help it.
Yeah.
So they are proposing that they will have the habitat part of Mars One, the place where the astronauts actually look, or the colonists, if you prefer, where they actually live and do most of their work, will be underground. So somehow, using rovers, they're going to launch rovers up before they launch any astronauts.
Along with some supplies and stuff like that to go out first.
I think the first scheduled landing would be just supplies. And then the second round would have the first rover landing. The rovers are going to be these robotic rovers, just kind of similar to the Curiosity rover, but with a lot of construction ability. Like they'd obviously have to be able to dig out and put up structures for the incoming colonists. The idea being that the colonists would arrive and mostly everything would already be together.
I've got a little bit about the timeline. Do you want me to?
Well, yeah, sure. We can talk a little bit about that and then jump back to this. But let me just say this. The whole idea about putting it underground is that by being under the soil, which we've already established is dangerous stuff all on its own, the soil would protect against radiation. And that, according to Mars One's frequently asked questions section, 5 meters of soil, which is about 16.4 feet of soil, would be equivalent to being protected by Earth's atmosphere and magnetosphere. So they would dig down 5 meters and put the habitats that far down. So almost two stories if you're thinking of a building. So you would imagine that you would arrive on Mars and then go down two flights of stairs and be two flights of stairs underground, and that's where you live.
Right. The idea is to launch supply missions starting in 2016, a rover launch in 2018, also starting at that point a live video stream from the rover, which features heavily in their stated timelines on their website, which cracks me up just a little bit. And I understand that this is how they're making money, but it's, you know, they're very like scientific advancement live on video. Yeah. And I don't know. It tickles me.
We're in that post real world, I guess.
Yeah. It's true. And then 2021 would be when the settlement components would launch, including 2 living units, 2 life support units, more supplies, and a second rover, along with a second video stream.
Right.
And then again, like we said, 2022 would be when the astronauts would launch, and 2023 would be when they would land, along with 5 other cargo missions that year.
Yeah, and the rover's job would be to actually collect those
bits that landed and
to put them together and to assemble them. And that blows my mind. The idea of a rover capable of maneuvering, lifting, carrying, and positioning these various modular components so that it can make a living space for the astronauts by the time they land. That's a really sophisticated job for a robot to do.
And robotics is advancing continually, but they're talking about launching this critter in 2018. That's 5 years off.
Right, which means that they have to start building it right now.
Mm-hmm.
They can't, you know, these things take a lot of time because they have to build it, they have to test it,
mm-hmm.
make sure that it's going to withstand the pressures that it needs to, that it can actually fulfill the functions of the mission before they even try and launch one. And of course, this also all assumes that all these launches are successful.
Of course.
And I mean, we certainly hope they are, but there's never a guarantee. You know, you can never be completely certain.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Mr. Worldwide himself, Pitbull.
A lot of artists in general, people that are very creative, sometimes tend to overthink. That's one of my number one rules. Don't ever overthink. You can think ahead, but don't overthink. And what I mean by that is when they start to write a record, they're like, oh, that's not the line. Oh, that's not this. Oh, it's not that. And everybody has a creative process. I'm not knocking it. For me, I just let it flow.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Going back to the Mars One fact about the radiation, they also had this helpful section, which I found, again, a little scary. It says, as described in an FAA and university study from 2005, a journey to Mars and back, in the case of the study totaling 536 days in space, would mean the chance of contracting cancer for 25 to 34-year-olds is around 10% for men and 17% for women. But let's compare it to people who do not go to Mars. In their lifetimes, men have a 12% chance of contracting prostate cancer, and women have 12.5% chance of developing breast cancer. Or let's compare it to people who smoke. Smoking more than 5 cigarettes a day leads to a 24.6% chance of developing lung cancer for men in their lifetimes and 18.5% for women. And finally, our astronauts will spend only 210 to 220 days in space compared to 536 days in the study mentioned above. Staying in Mars will result in much lower doses even if astronauts stay for a long time.
These numbers, you had put them in our notes and I kind of glanced over them and I was just noticing that that's not necessarily, those numbers don't all align because we're talking about very specific different types of cancer caused by very specific carcinogens.
Not to mention different time frames. They talk about how the chance
over
of,
a lifetime versus
over a lifetime over
age groups. And,
yeah, exactly. A lifetime versus a trip.
So like, this is a tiny bit misleading and shockingly unscientific for a group of people who are looking to go to Mars.
Right. Yeah. When you say a tiny bit misleading, you are understating it drastically. I think you're giving them too much credit because, I want us to have colonies on the moon and on Mars. Trust me. I think that that would be amazing and a phenomenal human achievement.
Oh, of course.
But I don't think we get there by downplaying some of the very real, challenges we face. And the way that this is worded, I agree with you, Lauren. This is not a very realistic, like, it's like smoke and mirrors, right?
Because
you're saying, hey, look, you might have if you were going on the space, you might have a 70% increase in developing cancer, but throughout your life, you could have this much. Yeah, but we're not talking about throughout my life. I'm talking about like on a road trip.
It also was, especially when you're recruiting, essentially civilians to get into this project. It's so hazardously misleading to put those kind of numbers in someone's head without that's irresponsible is what that is. Yeah. When you're encouraging 18-year-olds to hop on YouTube and apply for your program and you're basically lying to them with statistics.
Right. If you're not lying,
I'm sorry.
I just
went off a little bit.
You should. No, that's why I included that.
Usually, what Jonathan does.
Yeah, that's why I included those bullets because when I read that, I had that same reaction that you did. But I also, took a Benadryl before I came in here, so I'm a little calmer. But wasn't doing it to calm myself down. I was doing it because spring has sprung. So then let's talk about life support systems. Now, I was very curious to hear how they were going to provide life support on Mars. We've already ascertained the soil is dangerous. The atmosphere is not breathable. Mm-hmm. So how do you, and getting supplies from Earth, while that will continue to be a thing, obviously that's not going to be steady and constant. You're
right.
Going to get them in bursts of deliveries, and that you have to have some sort of self-sustaining element or else – what happens when
it's like
people...
Oregon Trail. Yeah. Eventually everyone gets dysentery. Space dysentery.
My question is let's say that you don't have that self-sustaining element there. What happens when the television show gets canceled? Right? That's a sobering thought. I mean, the main way that they're going to be able to have the money to keep people alive on another planet is through television. If people stop watching television, people die, right? I mean, that's what the story is. So you have to have some sort of self-sustaining element to it, or else you are consigning people to death.
Potential Nielsen rating actual death.
Yeah. Your show died, so did your astronauts.
Right.
I mean, that's terrible. But anyway, so they have addressed that, and this is how they plan on providing life support. So what are the things they're going to need? They're going to need water. Well, they're saying what they're going to do is they're going to extract water from the soil of Mars, this incredibly toxic stuff. But we know that Mars has some ice on it.
Sure.
So the plan is to dig up huge amounts of dirt and put them through what are called extractors. And the extractors will heat up the soil, which will melt the ice and turn it into water vapor. It will then condense and filter that water vapor to turn it back into water. And then that water will become the drinking water and also the water for the food supply at the colony. And the idea would that be that each life support unit on Mars would have about 1,500 liters of reserve water, as well as the water that's actually providing to the colony on a daily basis. So that way, by the way, they're getting power through solar panels. That's the idea, is they use solar panel arrays to generate the electricity they need to run the colony. But in the case of something like a dust storm where you don't get that solar power, you have to be able to still have access to the things that keep us alive.
Right.
Or you've just, again, killed the entire colony. So that's how they're answering water. So what about oxygen? Well, oxygen, they're also looking at the water. Some of that water that they will be gathering from the soil, they expect to pour some energy into it to break those molecular bonds. And we know that the two elements that make up water are hydrogen and oxygen. So you release hydrogen and you release oxygen. The oxygen you then mix with nitrogen, which you can get from Mars's atmosphere, and make it into a breathable mix, because pure oxygen would not be a good idea. You want to mix that. Here on Earth, the most abundant element in our atmosphere is nitrogen.
Mm-hmm.
Some people don't know that, but that's in fact what it is.
Pure oxygen will mostly get you high.
Yeah, and then dead.
And if, then you know, dead you can, pretty quickly.
Yeah, you can't have pure oxygen for long anyway. So you would mix that together to make the habitat's air supply, not the band. And then finally, where are they getting the food? And some of the food's coming from Earth. They'll be supplied, but that's supposed to be the, you know, kind of like emergency rations.
Sure.
The plan is to use hydroponic farms. Hydroponic farms don't require soil to mm-hmm. grow plants, and to use special LEDs to provide the specific wavelengths of light that those plants will need to grow.
Mm-hmm.
So these LEDs will, because they're LEDs, they draw very little power, so mm-hmm. you don't have to worry about running a whole lot of power to them. They will then give that specific wavelength that will give the plants the best chance to really grow in that environment.
And since we're doing this all of this underground, you don't have the cheery Martian sunshine to
right.
to fuel your
right exactly.
hydroponic gardens.
So you've got you're doing it all inside. That will also mean that it'll use the carbon dioxide generated not just by people breathing, but they'll also harvest CO2 from the Martian atmosphere as well. And so that's how they answer the water, oxygen, and food problems. That sounds like an oversimplification to me too. Again, this is talking about systems that we've proven that they can work on Earth, but you know, to expect that all of these are going to work on Mars is, I would hope they would, but it seems very optimistic, especially within the timeline that they have granted. Because we haven't run those kind of tests to make sure that we could do this kind of thing. And I would kind of want us to have a pretty high confidence level that it would work before we try
it. If I were one of the astronauts, especially, I would want that thing.
And they're talking about the habitats and the rooms that they're in being in these inflated, essentially kind of like inflated tents in a way, which makes me wonder how they design it so it can withstand the fact that there are nearly 17 feet of soil on top of them.
All the artistic drawings of the plans that I've seen have been these kind of bubbly little capsules above ground, so I'm not sure.
Well, and those are supposed to be the other, like, the life support units and stuff.
Okay.
The habitats, the places where
okay.
people live
sure. right,
are supposed
cool.
to be
below.
Underground. Like, if you look at
sure.
some of those pictures, you'll see, like, there seems to be something that looks like a tunnel that's built
okay.
up, a dome of Earth.
That's cool.
But yeah, I don't know.
Well, I mean, you know, and I think it's fair to kind of put this stuff out there, and especially since they're doing this essentially for profit, and it's all proprietary, keeping everything a little bit close to the chest, I could devil's advocate being part of their strategy.
Well, and also there's an argument that you can make saying that we're working on the initial stuff now. We have the plan to launch by 2023, and between now and then we may have developed the technology necessary to meet those challenges. I guess. I mean, this is the same sort of thing we hear
asteroid
mining.
It's a lot of questions, right? Yeah.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's, you know, it's my biggest question, honestly, is why we're looking at Mars and not, say, the moon.
I have that same question. I think, well, I mean, you've got some other problems with the moon.
Sure.
Obviously,
oh,
things
absolutely.
Like, you know, you have a 1/6 the Earth's gravity, for mm-hmm. example, which, again, raises the question of things like bone loss.
The moon is actually more toxic than Mars, from what I understand, in terms of the particulate.
But it's also much closer.
Very much closer. If things go wrong, it's a lot easier to correct.
Right. Yeah. You're talking, we've already got the experience of sending people there and coming back, you know, unless you believe the whole, television studio thing.
Right.
We did go to the moon in 1971, but the 1969 one was all in a movie studio. It was on Gentle Ben.
that aside, I mean, it's just the ethical questions that this raises of whether or not it's okay to A, send people to Mars on a one-way ticket at all, and B, to do it under the restrictions of reality TV. I mean, I think that anyone who's watched any amount of reality TV has seen that group breakdown that inevitably happens and is partially, I think, fabricated for the enjoyment or at least Schadenfreude of the viewers, wherein the group just hates each other and someone gets kind of Lord of the Flies out. And I just don't want to watch that. I don't know. Like, of course I want to watch people go to Mars. That's terrific and fascinating and science and, you
right.
know, human exploration. But at the same time, thinking about it makes me nervous for those poor people.
And, you know, it very well may be that the popular approach that they're taking, this kind of, you know, pop culture approach almost to the whole project, is really not indicative of how serious they are. So a lot of the judgments that we're making, a lot of the conclusions we are drawing, it's all based off of the approach we have seen. So maybe a lot of our concerns that we've raised are already well in hand. I'll go ahead and say that might be the case. And it very well could be that it's just our ignorance of the project that leads us to this skepticism. But anytime you're talking about people's lives, I think critical thought and skepticism need to be employed fully so that you can make sure that these people know what they're doing. They are very serious about it actually succeeding. They're going to take every precaution they can to protect the people's lives who are involved.
The mental and physical health of these people.
And to if all of that pans out, then the potential scientific information we can get from this experiment would be amazing. It'd be phenomenal. So I want it to work. I really do.
And like we say a lot here and also on our other podcast, Forward Thinking, even if it doesn't work out, even just trying could lead to terrific scientific advancements.
Right. And I mean, the space industry alone has created so many different advancements in technology and just things that we rely on a daily basis now that could very well be the case. So I really do hope that all of this is completely on the up and up and that we see some real results from this. It's just got enough warning flags for me to be really cautious about it. But, at the same time, like, if there's no risk, there's no reward, right?
Right.
And I know that there are a lot of astronauts out there who have done some phenomenal things that a lot of us would consider crazy. I mean, it would just.
Oh, sure.
People from the test pilots who were first testing the spacecraft before it ever left the Earth's atmosphere, to the people who have gone up to the moon or the International Space Station, these are phenomenal feats, and they require a great deal of courage and determination, more than I possess, frankly.
Oh, certainly me as well.
And I think it would be a shame to not encourage that. I definitely want to see that kind of indomitable spirit continue.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to make sure that it's the right project.
Sure.
And so far, I'm not fully convinced with Mars One. That's not to say that maybe in a year, maybe I'll say, oh, they've met every single one of my concerns with flying colors, and now I'm totally on board.
It could happen, but we'll have to see what develops. Yeah.
What would it take for you to go to Mars, Lauren?
I would not go to Mars. I mean, nope.
Yeah,
sorry.
Me neither.
I mean, especially under the restraints. I mean, to be fair, I also would not appear on a reality TV show, period. So
not with that attitude. News for you, Lauren. There are cameras everywhere. I've been doing the How Stuff Works reality TV show. We launch any minute now. It's mostly us sitting at our desks with headphones on, not paying attention to each other. It's not terribly exciting, I'll admit, but, you know, I've got high hopes. I mean, you occasionally see things like Josh talks to Chuck. I expect that to drive a lot of views. I also would not go to Mars unless there was a return ticket, in which case maybe. But with no return ticket, nah, all my stuff is here. So that alone makes it really hard for me to say goodbye.
I don't know. Yeah.
Not that I'm a materialist, but come on. You know, my Xbox is over here. I worked hard on that gamer score. It's totally a lie. I've got a terrible gamer score. Well, anyway, that's our overlook of Mars One. I really do hope that if this doesn't work out, I hope some other project that kind of takes note of it and tries to address some of the concerns that we have and approach it from a different way. I hope that happens, or that they answer my concerns and that this all works out, because that would be phenomenal. So we'll have to wait and see, find out if this actually pans out. And guys, if you were interested in this topic, let us know what you thought. Let us know, would you go to Mars? Is that something you would be interested in doing? Would you be able to say goodbye to everything else and spend the rest of your life on a totally different planet?
Have any of you applied yet?
Yeah, we want to hear from you. Let us know. You can write us. Our email address is techstuff@discovery.com, or drop us a line on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle there is techstuffhsw. We look forward to hearing from you, and we'll talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene! Gene Fodor!
Gene, was good!
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.